This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. What do I think of the term corporatism? Used by many libertarians to explain the fact of corporations receiving special favor from government. Is it a form of kissing up to the left by demonizing corporations? Yeah, definitely it's a form of kissing up to the left, but some libertarians have always been leftists, fundamentally. Many of them will admit this. They hate corporations, many libertarians do. So, I hate the term corporatism. I think it's a horrible term. There's no ism to corporatism. Look, the term ultimately is statism. Some people call it crony capitalism, but that's a perversion because there is no such thing as forms of capitalism. There's only one capitalism, which is protection of individual rights and free markets, true free markets, separation of state from economics. Other people call it, or I've argued we should call it cronyism. So it doesn't include the term capitalism. And that's better than crony capitalism, much better than corporatism, because it identifies the problem. The problem is to be a crony. The problem is this relationship between government and corporations. But cronyism is not the right word either, because it assumes that there's an ism here, that there's an ideology here, that there's a theory here, that there's somebody advocating for cronyism. Let's go cronyism. And there isn't. All cronyism is an aspect, a necessary aspect of statism. All statism, whether socialist or fascist or mixed economy, necessitates the interaction of companies, corporations, or any form of company, and government. So the government favors that they give corporations are a natural part of statism, unnatural to capitalism, completely unnatural to capitalism. Capitalism is the separation of state from economics, but a part of statism. So the real term here is statism. You find me a statist regime, a mixed economy type regime that does not have government helping up corporations and corporations lobbying government for favors. I mean, they all do. It's the nature of the mixed economy. So there's nothing added here by cronyism. Corporatism is awful because it plays into this anti-corporation bias, which, by the way, a lot of libertarians already have. If you're interested in my views on corporation, I have a lecture course on the Ayn Rand e-store. It's only 99 cents per lecture. I think it's 4 hours, on the nature of the corporations and why corporations are moral entities. Okay, so here's a kind of question on immigration. In a perfect capitalist country, with government limited to its proper role in protecting people's lives and property, what would happen to illegal immigrants? They wouldn't want to come here anymore because nobody would allow them to steal property from others through the welfare state. So do I think that illegal immigration would completely be eliminated if you eliminate the welfare state? I mean, this is kind of a weird question. First of all, I don't believe that most illegal immigrants who come to this country are coming in order to accept welfare. I think there's no empirical evidence of that. Most of them come here to work, to make their lives better, to be productive. Most of them land up paying taxes, not that that's a virtue, but land up working for a living. Some of them land up on welfare, but many of them don't intend to land up on welfare. They land up on welfare because they lose their job or whatever, for the same reason as many Americans land up on welfare. The implicit in this question is that all illegal immigrants come here for the welfare benefits. I don't believe that for one second. If anything, if the United States was free, if the United States was truly capitalist, more people would want to immigrate. Many, 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 many more people would want to immigrate. And there would be very little illegal immigration because a truly capitalist America would allow lots of immigrants to come in. It would have very, very few restrictions on immigration. So there would be no illegal immigrants because most immigration would be legal. What would be illegal immigrants? If you had a completely capitalist society, people could come here to work. People could come here to live. People could come here to invest. Why would people come here for any other? I mean, people wouldn't come here to get welfare because they wouldn't be welfare, but that would be it. So the implicit assumption in the question, I think, is wrong. The solution is true. Complete capitalism is good. And then basically the borders would be opened up, or opened up to a large extent, with the limitations being primarily for things like infectious diseases, terrorism, criminals, and things like that. But if you had a job in the U.S., or if you were going to buy property in the U.S., or if we would let you in? If a society with minimal government was about to start, what would happen with all the state property? Would somebody buy it, inherit them, or what? Well, I mean, I think given the amount of debt the government has, the most reasonable solution would be to sell it all. I think that's one of the ways the government should right now deal with the debt. It should sell all the property that it has. Three-quarters of all the property west of the Mississippi is owned by some form of government. This is a great way to raise revenue. Sell it all. Sell the desert. Sell the lake. Sell the rivers. Sell the buildings. So most of these institutions would be sold. Most of the property would be sold. Many of the institutions would be closed because they would be illegitimate. Some of them would be broken up and sold in pieces. So you don't need an EPA, an Environmental Protection Agency. You'd shut it down, fire the people, and sell the buildings. So those are the kind of things that would happen. Okay, so there's a question here about citizenship and what the paradigm is of citizenship. And so the real question is, what's the difference between somebody who resides in the country who's not a citizen and somebody who is a citizen? And according to this person, it doesn't seem to them that there's much of a fundamental difference. Anybody who resides it in here, I mean, since the borders are relatively open, they can come in and out. What is that special about citizenship? Well, a few things. One, citizens can vote, non-citizens cannot. Now, voting in a truly free society is not that big of a deal, but it's something. You get a vote for your representatives. If you're not a citizen, you don't get vote for them. The government has different responsibilities towards you. If you're a non-citizen, and let's say your property gets confiscated in some other country, the government doesn't worry about that. That's not the government's responsibility to protect your rights and your property overseas, for example. That's your problem and your government's problem, the government that where you are a citizen. There are probably other procedural, technical issues where the government, just in terms of due process, would treat you differently than it would a citizen. So citizenship obliges the government to treat you in a certain way. All the laws, all the full protection, for example, of the U.S. government, you have the full protection of the U.S. government in terms of your rights. If you're living here and not a citizen, you don't have a right for your rights to be violated, but you don't have the full protection of the U.S. government. You don't have everything that that implies in terms of foreign property, in terms of even due process within the United States. Now, what exactly are the differences? How does it all play out? I leave that to the philosophy of law and people who really think this through. I have not thought it through. It's not my expertise. But you have to understand that there are differences. To be a citizen is much more than to be a non-citizen, and therefore I think it should be hard to become a citizen. And even in the world today, I think you can do things like, I hate to say this because nobody should get welfare, but even in the world today, you could say something like, okay, citizens get Social Security, non-citizens don't. Citizens get welfare, non-citizens don't. Citizens can get these things, non-citizens could go, as a phase to moving towards a completely free society in which nobody gets those things. So the distinction is an important one, and I think one that has significance. So I think I've said in past podcasts, it should be easy to come into the United States. It should be hard to become a citizen of the United States, partially because citizenship implies voting. So this is about Australia, Aborigines. Australia's got this referendum that would apologize to Aborigines and declare officially in the Constitution that they are original landowners of the continent of Australia and so on. And this person is asking, is it right for him to say he's sorry and to vote for such a referendum? No, it's wrong. You should never say you're sorry. You didn't do anything. I mean, there's no question that horrible things were done to the Aborigines hundreds of years ago, 100 years ago, whenever it actually, over 100 years ago, whenever it actually happened. And that's sad and that's unfortunate. But it's not you. You didn't do it. You are not responsible for saying you're sorry and for regretting it. And there's also this whole question of, the Aborigines own the continent of Australia? Is that really true? What does ownership means in this context? They weren't using the land. The land was just available. Now, does some land was stolen from them? Yeah, I'm sure some of it was. I don't know the details of the history. And to the extent that that can be corrected or fixed, it should be corrected or fixed. But they didn't own the continent. They didn't own large swaths of land where they happen to walk around, they happen to roam. That's not how property rights work. So I don't think you should feel guilty about the Aborigines. I don't think you owe them anything. I don't think Australia qua nation owes them anything. The point is, are their individual rights protected today? If they are, this is the starting point. Let's live happily ever after from this point on. Okay, so here's one about revolution, I guess. If we had a good chance of succeeding, would it be moral for objectivists to overthrow the U.S. government? Well, what does it mean, a good chance of succeeding? To have a good chance of succeeding would mean that you would have a significant proportion of the population on your side. If you had a significant proportion of the population on your side, would you need to overthrow the U.S. government? Violently, I assume you mean. And if the answer is that's the only way, then yeah, it would be okay to use force to overthrow the U.S. government. There's enough rights being violated today to justify revolution. Our rights are violated probably more today than they were under King George. So if the founders of this country saw a legitimate right to revolution, as they did, if you look at the list of violations of their rights in the Declaration of Independence, where they explain in detail why they are in revolt, almost all of those apply today. So yeah, I think that if we had a good chance of succeeding, and if the only way to succeed was through violent revolt, then we would have a right to overthrow the U.S. government. But it's not clear to me it's the only way to do it, and I'm sure we wouldn't succeed today. So a lot of work to be done still. Does the U.S. government have the duty to protect the property of its citizens in foreign countries? For example, what kind of response should the government have if an American oil company was nationalized? Yes, the government has a response to protect the property of its citizens in foreign countries. Now, how it does that, where it does it, when it does it, is very complicated and requires somebody to really do some original work around this. You really have to think the issues through. So if the government of France takes away your property in some way, what should the U.S. response be? France is a relatively free country. It has a legal system. I think in that case, the U.S. government should protest, should try to use the legal system within France to help you out, to fight, to get your property back in some way. If in the 1950s, oil was nationalized by random countries in the Middle East, should the U.S. government have done something? Yes. In that case, I think there's no protection of property rights. There's no rights respecting government. There's no legal proceeding you can go through. The U.S. government should have been willing to use force in order to protect the rights of its citizens in those countries. But let's say China does it. It's kind of a powerful country. You don't really want to go to war with because they have nuclear weapons, but they also don't have an objective legal system that you can use in order to arbitrate disputes in. What should happen then? Well, I think what the government would do, and again, I'm a little speculating here because I'm not an expert. So this is a first pass at this, and I encourage somebody to do some serious thinking about this. One thing is the U.S. government should have a list and say, if you do business with these countries and these governments, we're not responsible. We're not going to protect you. Because the threat is so high, why are you even doing business with them, right? The Middle East is different because when companies went to the Middle East first to drill for oil, there were no governments, or they cut deals with those governments, and those governments were so weak, and it was insignificant. But if we know Venezuela is a horrible country, we don't want to go to war with Venezuela, but it's a horrible country, and you can't do business with them. We should tell our companies, if you do business with Venezuela, your problem, we're not going to protect you. But let's say it's okay to do business with, Colombia, and we've told our companies, yeah, and the companies do business, we say it's fine to do business with Colombia, and they're overthrown, and then the new government comes in and steals all the property of Americans. Yes, then the U.S. government has a responsibility to protect those companies, even if it involves military force.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peekoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.